I'm Phil C.
And I'm Lynn.
And together,
we're Roman Oz.
Real interviews.
With real people.
On location.
With a great mix of Aussie music.
As requested by the people we interview.
Follow us on Facebook.
Or check us out, romanoz.com.au. All interviews are live.
And on location.
And may vary in audio quality from segment to segment.
So, Phil, what's on the show this week?
Well, Lynn, we're all over the place in this program.
Yes, we are.
We are. We start off at the wonderful town of Westbury.
Yes, it's a lovely little town just out of Launceston, about half an hour.
It is. Now, last week we finished with Westbury.
Yes, we did.
Last week's
show. The distillery.
We did. And this week we're starting off at Westbury and we are at the Pernes Steamworld Museum.
Yes, and we're chatting to Robert, the secretary. And what a great museum it is.
And what a wealth of knowledge Robert is. Goodness gracious me. Talk about the museum for a moment. They've got everything from steam traction engines to foot spas, if I'm not mistaken. And old washing machines.
Yes. Oh, look, it is a great old place where they get all these collections from old properties and everything and stuff donated. And I think it started off with two brothers.
It did.
Yeah, collecting. And
yes, it did. And we talk about the two brothers.
Yes.
Okay. There's a little bit of an interesting story there, how one actually was given his name. I'm not going to give away too much, but it's in there his name came about. Now, after we leave Westbury, where are we going to from there?
Well, actually, we're going to Sheffield to the Steam Fest, where Pernes actually did take a traction engine up there. But we're going to be speaking to Brian the Bullock Man.
Now, also, let's just go back to Pernes for a moment. They also had a, I guess you'd call it like a pianola.
Yes,
but it was
did.
Steam-driven.
Yes, it was. That was at the Steam Fest.
It was amazing. It was an amazing instrument. They put these cards in.
Yes.
They're like books.
Punched cards.
It's actually a book, and you put the book in the machine, and they've got all these tiny little holes in them.
Like a pianola,
Like a pianola.
Yeah.
But it's steam-driven. That was amazing. And we did actually do a discussion with him, and that's going to be on another program.
Right.
Okay. So, yes, we get to speak to the Bullock Man. Brian, he tells us all about his bullocks.
Yes.
Okay. And what a huge beast of an animal.
They are.
They're
very well
trained.
Trained. That's the word I was looking for.
Well, we were at the Steam Fest.
Yes.
So that's why they were well trained.
Yes.
I give up my day job, okay?
Yes.
And then straight after that, we end up in Cobar.
In New South Wales.
That's right.
And we're speaking to Sam at the Great Cobar Museum.
Now, the last time we were in Cobar, the museum wasn't open.
No, it had been closed for a period of time for COVID and also remodelling.
Remodelling, and wow, haven't they done an incredible job in there. Well, look, Lynn, we're not going to say any more. I think it's almost time for us to do our thing.
Yes.
So apart from these great interviews, we've also got a fantastic selection of music as requested by the people we interview. So, Lynn, what do you think? On with the show! G'day listeners, Phil C here. This is Roman Oz and we are at Westbury at the Pernes Steamworld Museum and I'm chatting with the Secretary, Robert. How are you today, Robert?
Not bad at all, thanks. How's yourself?
Mate, fabulous. We're having a wonderful time here in Tasmania. There's so much to see and so much to do, so much history. And one of the things that brought us particularly to Westbury was this fabulous Steamworld Museum. Now, tell us all about the museum, Robert.
Well, the museum is mostly the collection of three brothers who were third-generation farming contractors locally, taking their equipment from farm to farm, as well as looking after their own farm, which was in Hagley, which is the next village to the east of us here in Westbury.
Yes.
It was their grandfather that actually got them into steam, in terms of steam power, back in the 1800s.
Right.
And they just carried on. But as steam started to give way to internal combustion, they kept their beloved steam engines and anybody else's they could lay their hands on. It was very much a case of they were trying to collect one of each type of steam engine that was in use in northern Tasmania.
Okay.
And they nearly completed the full set. We have a few bits missing in terms of a set, but they did a very good job of it. And as time gave way and their collection grew, they realised they wanted to share this with the public. So in it's 1987, they built the first shed of where we are now here in the museum. so that they could share it with the public, and also to, frankly, to show off a bit.
Okay.
Because they were very fine engineers in their own right, even though they actually only went to the local primary school for their education. They were self-taught engineers, natural engineers, absolutely brilliant. And there are various models, for example, around the sheds that we have here, where mostly Verdon, the middle brother, but he was a great model maker. And as you may gather, Verdon is not a usual name. He was actually named after the Battle of Verdun that was on at the time when he was born.
Okay.
So they grew the museum. The shed grew in size and in number. And they opened it to the public and so on and so forth. And they transferred to here what was effectively the first of the steam rallies that were happening in Tasmania. They'd started that back in 1965 at their own farm,
right.
Transferred it over here. So every November we have a full weekend where everything comes out that we can and get it in steam or get it moving. We have the Historical Machinery Club come to us as well. The local church does the catering, all this sort of thing. We have a mad weekend of everything going.
And that's right here in Westbury?
That's right here in Westbury, here on the site.
So when does that happen? What time of year?
That's the first weekend in November.
First week in November?
Yes.
Okay.
That's because we have an extra day holiday up here in the north.
Okay.
It's our recompense for Hobart having Regatta Day in February.
Okay.
We have an extra day in November. So it all rolls around with that.
Okay. So I understand the original ferns came to Australia from England back in the 1800s, is that right?
That's correct, yes. They did. And from what I understand, they were the original John Pern that came out was a blacksmith.
Right.
And so they kept that sort of hand in with machinery and so on, so it's obviously in the blood.
And I understand also that you have the largest collection. Is it in Tasmania or where is the largest collection?
The largest collection in Tasmania. It used to be thought to be the largest collection in the Southern Hemisphere.
Right.
But there are, over the last few years, there's various private collectors on the mainland who have made their own collection up and so on and so forth. So we've been sort of outstripped by rich people on the mainland.
They'd have to be filthy rich, wouldn't they? Because what would it cost for one of these engines?
Absolutely. But certainly we have the largest private collection in terms of an association.
Right.
Whereas other museums and so on and so forth that you go to, a lot of the engines would be privately owned but brought in by their owners into the association. Here, as an association, we own all the engines.
It's incredible. And you're all run by volunteers. This particular museum, it's all volunteers.
Absolutely, always has been, yes.
Wow. And how many volunteers do you have?
Active about 30. So we're not very big in number.
Okay.
But we still manage to be open every day by Christmas Day.
Okay.
And so, yeah, we're usually always here unless there's an emergency going on. Yeah.
And how many pieces and how many sheds do you have? Just for the listeners to know what they can expect to see when they arrive.
Ah, right. Well, we have the two main sheds.
Uh-huh.
They are actually, a lot of people think they're aircraft hangars.
Okay.
I mean, they are quite sizable. They're 70 metres long by about 18 metres wide. And they're sort of like big Nissen huts.
Okay.
Big sort of half circular Nissen huts. There's two of those. They've got the main exhibitions in them in terms of steam, horse-drawn, internal combustion, workshops, all that sort of thing. Then we have a forge on site where we have a blacksmith comes in from time to time and that. Another shed which is of storage and a few other bits and pieces.
Okay.
So, there's always stuff to be seen. There's the railway going around the outside, which is our own little 7 1/4 inch gauge railway.
Okay, that's just for display. The kiddies don't get to ride on that for a fee, or?
Ah, the kiddies certainly get to ride with it, and so do the adults.
Okay.
And sometimes we have the engine, the train full of you know, adults, and why not? Why should the kids have all the fun?
I guess so. I said kids because I thought, well, maybe you wouldn't want to load it up with a bunch of adults, but
what?
You did get lots.
Well,
fair enough. Yes. Fair enough. So
and there's no extra fee for going on. If you pay to come into the museum, the train rides are free.
Well, that was the next question I was going to ask you, just again for the benefit of the people listening in. How much does it actually cost to come in?
It's $10 for adults and $5 for children over 5.
Okay.
Carers come in for free.
Right.
And those with...
Pension cards
and the Defence Force card.
Okay.
They get a discount as well.
They get a discount. So it's a fabulous time out here. How long do you think people should allow themselves? Because this is a big question. I know you can say how long's a piece of string, but you got so much to see. Even if you weren't into the steam world, you'd still need a minimum of, do you think, to see everything?
Oh, it's a good half hour, 40 minutes or so. And, of course, as you quite rightly point out, I mean, our title is Steam Worlds, but steam is only about a quarter of what we have here.
Right.
Because we have all the horse-drawn equipment. The stationary engines from the internal combustion era. We've also got what we call the women on the land, because the Pern wives said, well, we want to show how life was for us.
Right.
So we have some wonderful examples, for example, of washing machines that go back into the middle 1800s when somebody had to do it by hand. So we've got, sort of kitchen setups and things like that. So it's not just about steam engines, but about rural life in the area.
Fantastic. I didn't know about the washing machines. So next time you have to do a wash, Lynn, you won't be complaining because you won't be doing it by hand. Imagine it would have been
pretty tough.
I was going to say, it would have been tough in those days, wouldn't it, back in that time, obviously.
Yes.
Very tough, very hard life.
Yes.
Fantastic.
And we're still getting some wonderful bits and pieces coming through at the moment. People are adding to our collection. Behind where you're sitting is a large, what looks like a huge dish with a spout.
Uh-huh.
And it's about just over a metre diameter. But only about 150 mil deep.
Yes.
And various people are coming and saying, well, what's that?
Uh-huh.
We would love to tease them. I know this is going out nationally.
But
this wonderful sort of thing. I said, when it first turned up, what is it? And it's actually a foot bath. And so it would be laid down and a little bit of water put in, and then you sort of wash yourself over. To some extent, as travellers around, you know what it's like to try and get a shower and so on and so forth.
Right.
Well, this was the sort of stand up and sponge yourself water over, it goes back into the dish. But this is different from the mid-1800s and came out of an old farmhouse recently. So this is before the era of the big tin bath in front of the fire stuff.
Yes.
So, we're still adding to our collection and adding what it is to, gone through agricultural life in this area.
So does a lot of your exhibits here come from people donating personal things, that, like the bath, for example, that was donated to the museum?
Yes, yes.
And any other items out there, the bigger items donated by people or private collectors?
Yes, there's a fair amount of donations coming through.
Donations?
Even in terms of steam engines, although we haven't had a donation of a steam engine because they are incredibly expensive.
Yes.
We have, for example, the last few years, we sort of nominally purchased for quite a low price a steam engine from the Hobart City Council.
Right.
It would have been the first engine they bought in the early 1900s and worked on the roads and then their yards and then the quarry sort of thing. They also had steam rollers and the like, but this is number one in their steam fleet.
Wow.
And that came to us with the idea that we would eventually get round to restoring it because it's in pretty low condition because it was sat outside for so many years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually at one point a recreation ground climbing frame.
Ah.
Oh. Of course, nowadays it's not right to have youngsters charging all over things and falling off things.
Of course.
So it was taken out of there, and it's ended up here.
So in relation to restoring it, you said you did have a blacksmith. Have you got people who can physically restore them? Because obviously you can't just duck down to the road and buy parts. I mean, how do you go about restoring them?
Thankfully, we have, as a member, a fully qualified boilermaker welder who specialises in heritage boilers and so on and so forth. And he's actually here today, or will be here today, going to be testing an engine that has been restored by two of our volunteers. It'll be the first time that a fire has been put in that particular steam engine for well over 20 years. But Mike will oversee all that. But yes, if there's any major work like that, it goes off to his workshops, which are in Penguin.
Okay.
And yeah, he does an absolutely brilliant job.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about Zenith Douglas, Robert.
Zenith Douglas Pern was the youngest of the Pern brothers. There was Jack, Verdon and Zenith. When Zenith was born, his mother wanted him called Douglas, but father for some reason decided that he would be called Zenith after his favourite carburetor.
So,
and it was actually when Zenith got himself an irreversible nasty that the whole thing changed here at Pern Steamworld.
Okay.
In that the brothers knew that they wanted to keep the collection together. And the only way to do that, with Zenith's sort of impending death, was to gift the whole lot of the collection to the community in the form of the Westbury Preservation Association, which is what they did. So the association was founded and took over the running of the museum back in 2002. And yet we're an entirely voluntary organisation dedicated to keeping the museum going. In their memory and also keeping their hope for it, which wasn't just about preserving the past, but also inspiring the next generation of engineers. And we do have graduates come to us from time to time to do practical projects so they can add something practical to their CVs rather than their rather sort of theoretical degrees. So, Zenith was that linchpin, as it were, even though it was through his illness that it happened that we transferred from being a privately owned museum to being a community voluntary-run museum.
Fabulous. The council doesn't have anything to do with it?
It used to in the early days, but since 2002 we've been entirely on our own.
Fabulous. That's the only way to be. Nothing against councils, but I think it should be left to the people who have the passion for it, which is the volunteers.
Absolutely.
And the community.
Yeah. Having said that, we do have a councillor who is a member of our team as well.
Okay. Well, then you've got the right man on the team.
Yeah.
Well, there you go, listeners. It's not just all about steam, Lynn.
No, it's
not. They've even got an old foot bath and washing machines dating back to the 1800s. So something for everybody to see.
Absolutely.
And well worth $10, and they get a free train ride.
Oh, yes.
What more could a tourist ask for? Robert, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks for coming.
Oh, I cannot wait to have a look at some of these engines, take a couple of photos for our website, and I'm sure you're going to get a lot of travellers come through.
We're always welcoming of travellers because obviously we don't get any government or council monies for running this sort of thing or our general running costs. We're entirely dependent on good people like yourselves coming in.
Absolutely fantastic. Well, we're going to wind this up now, Robert, and I always play a song and it has to be Australian at the end of every segment. Now, do you have a favourite Australian singer or band?
Well, I've always been drawn to the Seekers ever since I was a youngster.
Okay.
And one of their great songs, which links in with steam, of course, with here, is, of course, Morning Town Ride.
Absolutely.
Train whistle blowing, all this sort of thing. So that's always been a thing with those of us in steam, whether it be on rail or as these traction engines are because they go on the land, but they still have the whistle, that's a wonderful evocative sound of steam.
Unless, of course, it's waking you up at 2 a.m.
This is true.
And there is one that goes past, where were we, at Longford?
Yeah.
And there was one that used to, the train that went past every day, didn't it? Mm. Sounding the whistle and waking up all the campers.
Yeah, it comes through here at 4.
Fabulous. Well, thank you so much for taking the time, Robert.
I say thanks very much for coming.
There you go, listeners. That is Robert. He's the secretary of the Pern Steamworld Museum here in Westbury. We'll be back with more Roaming Oz straight after the Seekers' Morning Town Ride.
Train whistle blowing makes a sleepy noise under
Hi, g'day listeners, Phil C here. This is Raymond Oz, and I am chatting with Brian today. Brian's the bullock man here at Sheffield Steam Fest. How are you going today, Brian?
Wonderful, thank you. Big crowds and bullocks are working well. Everything's going good.
Fantastic, mate. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us. I know you're busy, although the bullocks seem to be doing all the work. How long have you been working with bullocks?
25 years.
25 years. They're a huge beast of an animal, mate. What made you want to work with them?
Well, started out with draft animals, which is animals that pull loads and keep the country rolling way back then. And when I left the horses, I was sort of ready to do something else and thought, well, bullocks should be another challenge.
Absolutely a challenge. Like, they are a massive beast. How much does your average bullock weigh? Because, I mean, I stood up against that black and white one there. You said they're only young juveniles, and they, mate, they tower over me. They're a massive animal. How much do they weigh?
They'd be close on a ton, about not quite 1,000 kilos. Those two little fellas, I call them little fellas because they're of their age, and they're my apprentices.
They're your apprentices now. Yep. How old are they when you say apprentices? And they're only young fellas.
They're 5-year-old.
5-year-old. Now you've got some bigger beasts back there, don't you? Some real monsters. How much do they come in? Do they come in at the same weight, or is that about the max they weigh?
Oh, about 1,300, the big fellas there, so they'd be a good 300 kilos heavier than the little fellas. Yeah, they are big bullocks.
They are indeed. And how old are the bigger ones that you got there?
11.
11, okay. So at what age do you start trying to train a bullock? You can't obviously get them too young, or do you have got to develop some brains first? When do you pick the age?
You start them at any time you like. You can start them, you can put them in the team as grown bullocks, or you can start them when they're still just off their mother, like a few weeks old.
Okay.
When they're big enough to be able to learn, and we give them the basic training, and then we turn them out for a while, let them develop, just get the basics on them, learn them to tie up and handle and get used to people, and we turn them out for a while.
So the two juveniles you got there, the black and white ones, they're only 5 years of age. How long have you been training those guys?
5 years.
Oh, 5 years you've been training them. Oh, wow. Okay.
I'll correct that a little bit, because they've been with me for 5 years. I bought them as little tiny calves.
Okay.
And I give them a couple of months playing with them, get them used to me, and then I turn them out and bring them back in and give them another couple of months and just slowly work them in over that period.
Okay.
They don't go into the team until they sort of get probably 2-year-old, because the bigger bullocks can tread on them and hurt them if they're too small. But
yeah,
that's how long I've had them about, yeah.
Okay. So how many's in a bullock team normally? Is it normally 2 or 6, or does it just depend on what sort of a load you're trying to move?
That's right on it there, yes. It depends on the load you're trying to move. Once you hook the bullocks together, put them in a yoke, I guess you can call them a two. Two can be a team.
Yep.
But we have got records here in Tasmania where they've had 100 hooked up. So it's really only a matter of the 100 was only for show. I usually work about 8 or 10.
Yep.
But I've got 14 at the moment, but okay. I've only worked part of them. Yeah.
So when you got a team hooked up, like, so let's say you got four or six bullocks all hooked up as a team. Does one bullock sort of, does he like the head honcho of the bullock? I mean, obviously you've got your whip there and you have your signals and you tell them what you want them to do. But is there one there that kind of says, come on, fellas, follow me? Is he the leader of the team?
Yeah, your near side leader, your bullock that you, that really does your work.
Okay.
He's the brains of the team, which is on your left-hand side, the near side one, and the other leader, he's pretty much the same. But they're the ones that they take the commands and they do the leading, and as I said, they are leaders, and they're the ones that the rest follow.
The other ones just follow. Incredible.
It's not quite that simple, but yes, they do follow.
So you say way back in the day, when did people start using bullocks to move heavy objects?
Not long after we were settled. As soon as the cattle started to come out here, we were using draft power. Our first form of any sort of power in Australia with draft power was convicts.
Yes.
And human power is not much good, especially if you were dragging a ball and chain.
Mm-hmm.
We were looking for draft power, and the cattle were coming in, and we found that, I say we, the way back then, 200 years ago, they found that the bullocks are very gentle, fairly easy to work with, and we had draft power there that we needed.
So they're a gentle animal, even though they're huge and they look very menacing and very intimidating. They are really a gentle animal. Are they easier to work with than, say, draft horses?
Most certainly. And I don't want to upset any of the draft horse people when I say that, because I've worked heavy horses all my life.
But mm-hmm.
Yeah, they are easier. They don't get quite as upset. And I say they're gentle big fellas. They are the majority of them. And then you can get one that'll kick you or tread on you or do something silly. But generally speaking, they are very, very easy going sort of an animal.
So have you ever had one tread on you? Because I'm thinking a thousand kilograms standing on your foot.
That can happen fairly regularly when you're yoking them up or trying to hook up a chain, they can step on you. Yeah, yeah. Sure. That's how you learn to talk bullocky when one treads on you.
So with the bullocks that you got two juveniles there, they're 5 years of age, they're your apprentices, you're still working with them. What sort of loads would a bullock of that size and age be able to move easily without putting him under too much physical stress, for example?
Half his weight, we quote. If a bullock weighs 1,000 kilos, we on a log, particularly if it was on a shoe, which means the log slides a lot easier, you work on half their weight. So if you've got one that's weighing 1,000, you work on your pull of half a ton.
Wow.
But we don't expect them to pull it all that far. We probably go 100 yards and stop and give them a spell and come back. And that's dragging logs. But if you put it on wheels, well, then they can sort of continually walk along and cover a fair bit of country.
Wow. So six hooked up together. Could be 6 times 5, so you're talking, what's that, 6 times 30?
3 tonnes.
3 tonne. And they can move 3 tonne. That's like that's a big-size caravan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no, they'd do that if it was on wood. But look, the bullies today don't pull like they used to. We don't have to make livings out of the bullies now. It's just some of the bullies drivers still get the bullies pulling well. The ones I've got there are mostly show bullies now. And,
yeah.
I would say they'd probably handle 2.5 tonne pretty comfortably.
Okay. So you're only doing it for show now. Did you ever have bullocks that you used to use on your property, say, for example, or is it just purely a show thing for you now?
No, we still use them on the property.
Mm-hmm.
Can't drag our firewood with. We wouldn't have to use them on the property. We
have
tractors, but we still do use them. Yes, I don't have to make a living out of them.
We still
do use them. Have to use them to get them up to that standard. If you don't use them and keep them in training and they get big, fat and lazy, like they've probably got. So it's fairly important that, yes, you do have to work your bullocks, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, because if you don't work them every day, are they a stupid animal? Would they forget what you taught them, or do they just get fat and lazy?
No, they never forget. Once they're broken in properly, those big fellas that I had there at Steamfest hadn't been hooked up for Brighton show back in, when was that, November, so they had November, December, January, February. They'd had about 4 months off and hadn't been taught the four bigger fellas. So, no, once they broke in properly, you can leave them out.
And how long does it take to break them in and to train them their routine so that they can be left in the paddock for 4 months and not forget?
Your leaders, it takes quite a while. You'd want 12, 18 months, probably 2 years to get a good pair of leaders going to how I'd like them going.
Yes.
But just to get them to pull, once you put them in the middle of the team, a month or so, so you get the gear on them and they'd be pulling and working quite well.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of difference between getting your leaders going and your body bullocks going.
Yeah. So the leaders, how do you select a leader from just from a guy in the middle of the pack?
Mainly his temperament. A good, clean working bullock is something that's got a few more brains than the others. Just something that will catch your eye and think, well, yeah, he looks a little bit kinder than some of the others and he's a little bit easier to break in and he's got to have a lot of patience. And by the time you get them broken in, you can usually see what they're going to do.
Okay. Because obviously you wouldn't want a sort of a nasty, sometimes you get horses together and all they want to do is bite each other and chase each other. That wouldn't be much good with a bullock team. So you wouldn't want a cranky one in the middle of the herd, would you?
No, that's not. Well, those sort never make a bullock. If they're a bit touchy, we don't go on with them.
Mm-hmm.
We cull them out pretty early.
Yes.
Most bullocks you get want to be part of it. They're quite happy to do it. And it's a pretty good life skill because those bullocks that are there now, that you're looking at there now, they've had 3 lives that a normal bullock wouldn't have had. So if they're 12-year-old, probably had 4 lives because most bullocks disappear. You know where they go and they're only about 18 months, 2 years old.
Yeah.
So they've had a pretty good life, those fellas.
They end up in the abattoirs. they end up on someone's dinner plate.
You said that, I didn't.
No. So those ones, are they like pets? Are they like family members? Can you call them by name and they wander over to you from the other side of the paddock? Or, cause they...
Yeah, they do. They definitely all work on their name. They definitely know their names. There's no risk of that at all. They do know their names. Mm-hmm. As far as walking over the paddock, sometimes they go in and you can't kick them out of the road, and other times if they're not in the mood, they won't come. But no, they do work off their names. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
They do know their names.
So what about to buy one then? What does a bullock cost, and does one bullock cost double another bullock? How do you sort of say, well, yeah, that one's worth this much, but no, that looks like a bit of a mongrel bullock. I'm not going to pay that. Is it bloodlines, or is it just you look at it and you think, yep, that's going to make a good bullock?
Yeah, well, it's something there that I don't know of anybody in Australia that's ever bred a bullock to be a working bullock. You mostly pick them up that somebody's got rid of them, they haven't got good enough to kill, they're not fat enough,
mm-hmm.
a little weedy fella, the horns are wrong or something there. So normally you just pick up your bullock cheaper than anywhere else because nobody wants him. He's a bullock that hasn't done quite well as the others have done, hasn't been sold. Mostly buy them, probably on today's price of $600 to $700 for a good lump of a bullock,
mm-hmm.
$300 to $400 for a calf. And once they're big, I don't know of any bullock that's been sold for a long time to really put a price on them. But if you were to put meat price on them, you'd be looking at over, $4,000 to $4,500.
Yeah, but for meat. But what about those big fellas that you got there? You wouldn't want to part with one of those?
No, well, and as I said, I wouldn't really like to put a price on them, no. And finding somebody that wants to buy an old bullock these days would be like trying to find gold, because most people that's in it now, which is a very small number of us, is left throughout Australia, is they'll start out as a calf and bring them so they've got something.
Mm.
Way back you would have bought 4 and 5 year old bullocks, going back when those bullocks were being worked. But today you'd have a job to go and find a good old heavy broken in working bullock for sale.
Yes. And what's the age of the bullock when you think, now he's done his time, he's served his time, he's done me well, I'm just going to let him go out in the paddock now and live out the rest of his days?
Again, it varies. It's a bit like how long's a piece of string. Some bullocks will go till the last good old leader I had, old Major, that come from Sheffield, actually.
Mm-hmm.
He went late. He was 18 when I retired him.
Yes.
And some of them will retire. What do I say? Someone might go out at 8 or 9 year old. It depends on the build, the structure, and arthritis, and all sorts of things happen. But
yep.
I would say sort of 15 or 16 to be a good average age for a working bullock.
Oh wow! So those big fellas you got there—they're almost at the end of their tether now. They said they're 11 or 12.
They're getting well through, unfortunately. Yeah.
Mm. So what's going to happen to them? You're just going to let them sort of wander around out in your paddock on your property and just let them enjoy the rest of their lives in the sun, or when they're finished doing the shows?
Yeah, that's just what will happen with them. Yeah, we've got, fortunate enough, we've got enough property to be able to turn them out with a plenty of grass over the next couple of years. And when they do retire, they'll just go out and we'll retire on the place, and mm-hmm. they will stay there till they either get crippled and can't get up, or something goes wrong, and then they're euthanized on the property.
Yep.
They've given you a long service, and they've been friends with you for a long time. So, we give them that chance to live out their life.
Fantastic.
Some of them, unfortunately, when you do go, you leave them with the bullocks, so they're still with their mates. And what we found with some of the older bullocks, when you take the others away to a show, it doesn't do them too good to leave them home, because all they do is want to go on the truck and they walk up and down till the others come back. They really get upset when you take your mates away from them.
Oh, really? So they really do have a bond with each other?
Oh, there's no doubt about that. The whole team has, and then, of course, the ones that they're coupled with, the ones they work with, you'll see them in the paddock, they'll be the two that will be together.
Wow, okay, I didn't realise that. So they actually, they recognise each other, they've bonded, they're part of a team, and they want to be together.
Oh, absolutely. By the time you bring them in to get the oats on and hook them up, they'll be walking side to side. And they do definitely, if you take, or you lose one, or if one gets crippled and you take him out of the team,
yep.
Time for another week in is very, very hard. They don't accept him real quick.
Okay. So they just won't, you can't just put any pair of bullocks together and expect them to like each other straight away. Takes a while.
No. Well, sometimes they don't accept them. I've had them that's probably worked together, but they never really accepted them.
Okay. So, Apart from the Sheffield show, Brian, what other shows have you been doing and how long have you been doing the shows and what have you got coming up in the way of shows and for the next sort of for the rest of the calendar year?
Well, we had got a function coming up at Oatlands on the Thursday after we leave there. Then we've got Grim Creek show once we leave there. Then we've got Agfest, Hobart show, Huon show, Hamilton show. Yeah, there's quite a list of things coming. Oh, we've got the Oatlands Heritage Festival. We've got quite a lot on, yeah.
Wow, so you're working a lot. This is not just a hobby. This is actually a job. It's a career, and obviously you enjoy, you love doing it. I can see the way you work with these bullocks, and I can see the way you interact with the crowd, that you really enjoy doing what you're doing. It's a job, but it's not really a job.
Well, it's not financially, I can tell you that much. But okay. I enjoy doing it, and I don't charge too much to do it. As long as I get my costs and can make a day's wages out of it, it's not going to make us $1 million. But no, I love doing it.
Yep.
And I love talking to people and getting people involved. It's just about to just go out and drive the bullocks around. And some people say, oh, you're lucky you can talk to people. Well, that's something I've worked on over a long time. And you've got to have the crowd, get them involved, because if they're just sitting there looking at the bullocks, they can sort of get sick of it and walk off. But if you get the crowd involved,
absolutely,
and tell them a few stories, it goes down a lot better.
For sure, for sure. And you're a fabulous showman, Brian. I've got to say that to you, my friend. Anybody who has the opportunity of seeing you and your bullocks work is certainly going to be entertained. They're not going to walk away bored.
Oh, well, I hope not.
Definitely not. Brian, thanks so much for taking the time to chat with us today. It's been an absolute pleasure for me, and I know my listeners are going to love this one, for sure.
Appreciate it, and thanks for showing the interest.
Thank you so much, mate. Now, I've got to wind this segment up. Do you have any old favourites, Australian singers or bands or Australian songs you think you might like? I can play one for you right now.
You better play The Old Bullock Grey. It would go down really well.
The Old Bullock Grey by Lionel Long.
That's the one.
That's the one, mate. It's my pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time, Brian.
Catch you later.
Righto, listeners, will you stick around? That was Brian. He's the bullock man from Oatlands. And if you see him out there, make sure you stop, watch his show, and he's more than happy to chat with you about his bullocks. We'll be back with more Roman Oz straight after Lion Long, The Old Bullock Grey.
Now the shearing is all over and the wool is coming down. I mean to get a wife, me boys, when I go to town. Everything has got a mate that brings itself to view, from the little paddy melon to the big kangaroo. So it's roll up your bundle and let us make a push. I'll take you up the country and show you the bush. I'll be bound, such a chance you won't get another day. So roll up and take possession of the old bullock grey. Wood beef and damper, of that you'll get enough. While boiling in the bucket, such a walloper of duff. My mates, they'll dance and sing upon our wedding day, to the music of the bells round the old bullock dray. So it's roll up your bundle and let us make a push. I'll take you up the country and show you the bush. I'll be bound, such a chance you won't get another day. So roll up and take possession of the old bullock dray. There'll be lots of little children, you must remember that. There'll be Buck Jumping Maggie and Leather Bellied Pat. There'll be Stringy Bark Peggy and Green Eyed Mike. Oh yes, Michael Odeo, as many as you like. So it's roll up your bundle and let us make a push. I'll take you up the country and show you the bush. I'll be bound, such a chance you won't get another day. So roll up and take possession of the old bullock grey. Now I am married and have children 5 times 3. No one lives quite so happy as my little wife and me. She goes hunting all the time to while away the day, when I take down the wool in the old bullock dray. So it's roll up your bundle and let us make a push.
I'll take you up the country and show you the bush. I'll be bound such a chance you won't get another day. So roll up and take possession of the old bull of gray.
7th Street Caravans have now moved to a brand new location. 11 Clayton Road, Heatherbrae is where you'll find them. Whether you're looking to sell, trade or upgrade, they'll look after you. Check out their range, Silver Valley, Hurricane, Paramount, Road Trip or their flagship Option RV. They won't be beaten on price, so get yourself a knockout deal today. They're open 6 days a week. Why not give them a call on 02-4987-5288 or check out their website, 7thstreetcaravans.com.au.
Hi, g'day listeners, Phil C here, this is Roman Oz and we're in Cobar on this particular discussion and I'm chatting with Sam and Sam is from the Great Cobar Museum. How are you today, Sam?
Well, thank you, Nisha.
Thank you. Oh, fabulous. Fabulous in this wonderful town of Cobar and thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
No problem.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit. I understand, Sam, you are born and bred in Cobar.
I am an iron ringer. Yep. So, and they say that anyone born in Cobar has an iron ring around them which can never be broken.
Okay.
And it is a term that just brings community into town. We're actually building a replica statue over the road just to remind people about it. Okay. Even a term in the Macquarie Dictionary.
Okay, an iron ringer.
That's an
interesting one, listeners. I've not heard that term before. Tell us a little bit about the town of Cobar, because you're born here, you've lived here all your life. What is the history behind Cobar, do you know?
So in 1870, Campbell, Hartman and Gibb discovered copper right here on this site, along with their Aboriginal guides, Frank and Boney, and they found some green water and a green rock. So they picked it up and took it with them down to Mount Hope Pub, where they ran into a Balgal there called Sidwell Cruz. She worked in England and she identified it as copper.
Right.
So they came back, they staked their claim in Bourke, and it all went from there. It was one of the leading copper mines in the world before World War One.
And the mines here in Cobar are still running?
Yes, we've got copper, lead, zinc, silver and gold.
Okay. And I noticed across from the museum, you've got the memorial over there.
Yeah. So our memorial was opened in June 2021 as a memorial for the miners who lost their lives in the mines of Cobar.
Okay.
And it is a wonderful attraction that is great for people to go and listen to some of the stories and some locals who have performed some music specifically for this memorial.
Okay. Now, I noticed, because we had a look in there, the youngest person that I saw who died was 14.
Yes. Unfortunately, there has been a lot, but one thing that we do love to look at in there is watching how the number of plaques started to go down. So you'll see big clumps of time where there were quite a lot of tragedies, but over time it shows just how much mining has progressed and how much safety has increased.
Okay.
My great-grandfather is actually one of the plaques in there.
Okay.
So he had a bit of an incident with the ball mill, and my grandfather became the man of the family at 13 years of age when his dad was killed. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's very personal for me.
Wow.
Yeah.
So the youngest was that young chap, 14. The oldest was 72. And as you said, they're all dated and there hasn't been any tragedies for a long time.
Not for a few years. We have had some within the last 10 years.
Okay.
But it was not about safety. It's more due to personal concerns.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that opened, you said, because the last time we came to Cobar, not only was that not open, but the Great Cobar Museum wasn't open. So when did the memorial open again?
So the Miners Memorial opened in June 2021, and we are so proud to say that our renovations for the museum finished, and we reopened November 30, 2021, and we since won a Judge's Choice and the National Trust Awards for 2022.
Which is fabulous. Now,
yeah.
Tell us, for the benefit of our listeners, what can people expect to see in the museum?
So our museum is quite comprehensive. It goes from the early days with the Aboriginal history and through into people, place, country and also into the mining. So it's quite comprehensive. It's not just about mining, it's also about the social and pastoral history.
Okay. There's a charge, I'm assuming, to come to the museum?
$5 each if you have a concession, $10 otherwise, $20 for families.
Yes.
So very good price point for everybody, very affordable, and we are very flexible. We let people come and go have lunch and come back and things like that as well.
So the famous old question, how long's a piece of string? How long should a person give themselves once they come to your museum? I mean, it is a silly question, but
it's one of those questions that's very hard to answer, but I generally say to people, look, if you're a reader, give yourself at least an hour.
Okay.
If you're not a reader and you skim through, give yourself at least half an hour. But we have such amazing artifacts here, and we're actually about to start renovations on the outside. So we've had $2.8 million worth of renovations inside, and we're about to start outside, where we'll have an underground mining exhibition and all sorts of things. So we're very excited for that. Lots ahead, and we can't go past our Far West Children's Carriage, because okay. The Royal Far West Health Scheme started out here in Cobar by Reverend Drummond and is still running in Sydney today. We have one of the original carriages.
That's a must see.
Okay. We're very proud of it.
So apart from that, which is the must see, what other attractions do you have in Cobar for travellers?
What don't we have?
Okay, well, tell us, Sam. What do you have? Give us a list of your top five, your opinion.
Ooh, I love them all. Okay. That's like picking my favourite chocolate. Okay.
So, well, then just tell us what you think that people would be interested to see.
Not in order.
Okay.
You can't go past the Cobar sign, but any entrance to Cobar, you'll come across a very unique Cobar sign.
Yes.
The big one that is at the entrance to the eastern side of town was the original chutes from that they loaded the ore into the railway carriages from the Great Cobar Copper Mine. It's made by local metalworks students, the letters, and it's a bit of a rite of passage to stop and get a photo there. Okay. It's also a great free camping spot.
That's a good idea.
That is a great one.
Free camping there.
Yes.
And there's toilets there as well?
There is toilets. There are RMS service toilets. Uh-huh. And there's a lot of room there. And we are very welcoming for free campers. We have quite a few options here in town. So that's a big one.
Before we go into the other attractions, you do have other free camping in the Cobar area?
So there is an amazing property called Glen Hope. It's about 5.5 km on the eastern side of town.
Uh-huh.
A lovely family has let people use their front paddock for camping, and they're more than welcome to just pull up, find a spot, find a nice shady tree, and it's all set back off from the road, nice and safe. And then there's also the old reservoir. You can go out there. It's absolutely beautiful at sunset time, and always good for a swim in summer.
So there's three areas to camp for free here in Cobar.
There are three free camping areas. We do have a lovely caravan park as well, but we do have plenty of free camping.
Yes.
And we also have Miralda Station, which is in town as well. They also have paid camping, bush showers. They do all sorts of packages as well. So lots of options for people.
Lots of options. Sensational. Yeah. So if you don't want to go free, you've got the caravan park.
Plenty of options.
Now tell us, okay, that was one of the ones.
Yes.
Tell us some of the other attractions now, Sam.
All right, we can't go past Fort Bourke Lookout. So that is a gold mine that you can look over the top of. We're a mid-sized mine in comparison to the Super Pit in Kalgoorlie. But you can see the original workings from the mine.
Okay.
And they follow the seams down. You can see that where they follow it. And if you're lucky enough, you will see a truck come out. Not always. It's a 24/7 working mine, but it is beautiful at sunset. It's one of the must-dos.
Okay.
Also, so
that's number two. Not in any order. Okay, we won't. It's not her favourite, listeners. Okay, it's just this is the second one she spoke about.
As a photographer, it's pretty spectacular. It's one of my points for sending other photographers out to. So
fabulous.
That's a must do.
Fabulous. The next one.
We can't go past the Cobar Sound Chapel.
Okay.
The Cobar Sound Chapel was opened in April 2022.
Right.
It was an initiative by George Lentz, who is a composer from Sydney, and Glenn Murcutt, who is a well-renowned architect, to convert a pre-existing water tank into a sound chapel.
Right.
So they play a composition of music. It's a 24-hour piece, and it is amplified within the tank. And there's also some beautiful inscriptions in there as well. It's been featured on the ABC. They've just been listed for a National Trust Award, and they're also up for an art award, which is fabulous. I've had people come from as far as America just to see this.
Wow.
So it's pretty spectacular.
So is there a charge for that?
So we do just ask that people pay a $300 cash bond to get the key, but that's given straight back to them as soon as they come back. So
okay.
It's essentially free.
Free. Okay. Hmm. And now the bond. How do they pay the bond?
It's cash only, okay. Set down by the Sound Chapel Committee. If they're also interested in nighttime bookings, they can contact them directly and have a nighttime experience, which is amazing in itself.
Fantastic. Yeah. So they come to the information centre, they give you the bond, $300 cash.
We do recommend advanced bookings because it books out very quickly.
Okay. So there you go, listeners. Book in advance. Make sure you've got cash, but you will receive it when you give the key
back. Straight back.
Fantastic.
That's why it's cash. Okay.
And the next one you think people will be interested in?
Look, we can't go past Mount Grenfell. Mount Grenfell is 65 kilometres out towards the western side of town, towards Broken Hill. Fully sealed the whole way. Aboriginal art site out there. It is very culturally significant because it is a meeting place from different tribes where they would follow the river.
Right.
And so the art is not just one tribe. It's quite a few different ones. Okay. So very significant.
Okay. And the next one?
Testing me.
I'm testing you. Yes, I am.
So we've done the museum, we've done the sign, we've done the lookout, the Miners Memorial, the Sound Chapel, Mount Grenfell. Okay, I would recommend our Heritage Walk or Drive. It is an amazing walk or drive around town.
Yes.
With 41 points of interest, with all the old buildings and a little bit of history about each of them. And there is a lot of history in this town, which we are very proud of and we're always happy to share.
Fantastic. So as you can imagine, listeners, when you come to Cobar, it's not just about having a photograph in front of the magnificent sign. There's so many things to see and do here. How many days do you think a person would need to really appreciate the town of Cobar?
Minimum of two.
Okay.
Yeah, there is so much to see and we recommend you come and see us. Let us show you the hidden gems. Come and meet our people. Our people are what we pride ourselves on.
So fantastic.
My job is to give the best first or last impression a person can get in town, but let our people show you because that is what we're the most proud of. I'll give you an example of what our town's about. We had a truck driver come into town. His truck caught on fire in the edge of town. Within 1 hour, he had a wallet full of money, a bag full of clothes, a ticket home, and he was all set. That's our town.
That's your town. So everybody in town rallied around and...
Whether you're here for 5 minutes, 5 decades, you'll be treated the same. Smile, absolutely. Wave, how are you going?
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Wow. I don't know what to say with that. You've caught me speechless, Sam, and that doesn't often happen.
I love my town.
I can see that, and you know a lot about it, and there's no time limits with the free camping if person wanted to stay 2 or 3 days to really soak up the ambience of the town.
You could always enjoy a few of them. You don't have to stay in one spot.
No.
You can enjoy all of them.
Absolutely brilliant stuff. Sam, thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks
now, you met us and you greeted us at the door. What are all your duties in the museum? Is it just, what do you do?
Yes, so my role is to tourism officer. This is my 10th year of being here, so as you can tell, I love my job because I'm still here.
Okay, yes.
So my job is literally to tell people where to go. Depends on the day, what that consists of. Quite often I get people that, they've had enough of stirring their partner in the car, so they'll come stir me, and I'm more than happy to give it back tomorrow. So, not only that, just greet them, let them know what we have, show them through the museum. I also jump on coach tours and give tours around town. So that's another thing that I do incredibly love.
Okay.
We're also very proud of our place on the Kidman Way. So for anyone who doesn't know, the Kidman Way is an approximate 800-kilometre stretch of sealed highway between just past Burke at Barangun all the way down to Jerilderie. It's not named for Sir Sydney Kidman specifically, but for his vision to open it up as a link in the chain between Melbourne and Darwin. So I do also go away to the caravan and camping shows and help promote our place on that and let everyone know about the Kidman Way, because you can go north, south, east or west from here. You're not limited. People might say we're in the middle of nowhere, but I say we're in the middle of everything.
Fabulous. I didn't know that. It's sensational.
Yeah.
I think you should be a regular on the program.
Well, come back as many times as you want.
Thank you so much for your time, Sam.
No problem.
It's not only your wonderful gleaming smile, but a wealth of knowledge and information. Thank you so much.
All right.
I'm going to wind this up now. Do you have I won't say a favourite, but you like Australian music?
Got to go with Australian music.
Okay. Is there one in particular, singer or band, that I could play a song for you?
Look, we can't go past Lee Kernaghan's Cobar Line because that talked about coming out here. The train comes as far as Cobar and stops in our CSA mine, and the mine all goes from here to Newcastle. So it's all about that. So that would have to be it, I reckon.
Sensational. Thank you so much for your time,
Sam. No problem. Thanks for having me.
There you go, listeners. That's Sam from the Great Cobar Museum. My name's Phil C. This is Roman Oz, and we'll be back with more of it straight after Lee Kernaghan's Cobar Live.
Were empty, my luck had run cold. Sit alive with me, just don't get on the streets and hungry, down and out. Going back to Cobar, goodbye city town. I jumped the freight, I'm heading back. My destination's down that railroad track. I'm gonna ride the Cobar line. Better days, she was the queen of the mine. There's a room at the back, she's an old miner's friend. There'll be food on the table, a roof over my head. I jump the freight, I'm heading back. My destination's down that railroad track. I'm gonna ride the Cobar line. To the dirt and the dust and the grit. Down in a hole where the sun never goes. Doing time on the mother lode. I jump the freight, I'm heading back. My destiny's down that railroad track. I'm gonna ride the Cobar line.
Hope you enjoyed the show, listeners.
If you missed any, check out our Facebook page, Spotify, or RomanOz.com.au.
Tune in next week for more
Roman Oz.